You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
It's been an exciting month for space exploration and planetary hopping, or object hopping, around the solar system. We'll start off with the latest mission to be hopping around on the surface of an object, which is Hayabusa 2, this Japanese mission that's launched to, or that's been in orbit, or been orbiting around asteroid Ryugu for the past few months. It sent down two little rovers which hopped around, and the satellite itself has now touched down on the surface.
That's right, yeah. I think there are four rovers in total, but quite unlike what you think of as a rover, you think of as something with wheels that will sort of pootle around. But these rovers, because you've got an asteroid which doesn't have a very intense gravity field, like something like a moon or a planet, if they did have wheels and they were trying to go around on the surface of it, they would just fly off because the gravity is so inconsistent as they moved around. So it's actually much better for them to just hop around and sample different bits. And yeah, and like you say, Hayabusa 2 itself is now, the whole satellite is going to effectively dock with the asteroid, scoop up, I think, three canisters worth of material, and take them back to Earth.
Yeah, and it's just on the first of those. So as we record this last night, which lets you date the recording if you're paying attention, the Hayabusa 2 rover the spacecraft, descended down to the surface, extended a 1 meter long sort of funnel out the front of it, fired a bullet, a 5 gram bullet into
the surface.
A kinetic
penetrator.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically a harpoon.
It was a bullet-like thing, a tiny bullet that fired at, I think, 300 metres a second, so quite fast, into the surface to throw up a cloud of debris, which then some of it will be gathered by the spacecraft. There were some surprises. The first touchdown was meant to happen last year, but the surface wasn't quite what they were expecting. It's much more covered in boulders than asteroids normally are, than the ones we've seen before. So that meant finding a landing site was difficult. Their initial plan was, to have a 100-meter diameter region that they could go, oh, we'll go somewhere in that region. But with so many boulders, the risk was that the spacecraft would hit a boulder as it went down.
This is also a problem for the Rosetta mission, with Churyumov-Gerasimenko had boulders all over it. It also had that strange rubber duck shape as well, which was a little bit unexpected. With a mission like this, you never really know what it's going to be like until you really get there, because something this small, and this is actually a Ryugu is a near-Earth object, so it's relatively close compared to in the Rosetta mission, the comet then was on an orbit that took it close to the sun and far away from the sun, but never as close as this is to the Earth. From the ground, it's very, very difficult to get a picture of something as small as this. You can actually do it with radar for bigger near-Earth objects, but then seeing boulders is totally impossible. You can get an outline of the shape and maybe how reflective it is.
Yeah, and a feel for how fast it's rotating. And
that's right.
So on.
Yeah.
I think the landers, what they did is they let the mission study the surface and see details close up. And one thing that was surprising there was that when we see asteroids like this, or previous asteroids we've landed on, have been covered in very, very fine-grained material.
Yeah.
Think of kind of moon dust on the moon, very fine-grained stuff. Whereas this asteroid, Ryugu, is covered in chunks that are about a centimetre in size. They're much bigger.
Mm.
And so there was a concern that actually the bullet wouldn't give them enough momentum or deposit enough energy to lift them up and be captured. So they did some tests on Earth. And they're... Hopefully it's worked. Hayabusa 1 had a problem a decade and a half ago. I forget. It was a long time ago. Where its landing didn't work properly. It was a very unlucky mission. Hayabusa 2 seems to have gone much better. And it's got more, as you said, it's got three touchdowns planned in total. The next touchdowns are going to involve, they're going to lower or release a small bomb, basically, to go down to the surface and then blow up a bit of the asteroid to leave a crater, so that when it goes down again the next time, it will sample material from beneath the surface.
Yeah.
This time, obviously, only got material from on the surface. And then return it to Earth and study it. So it's at the asteroid for about another I think this year and maybe into next year, and then it starts its return journey to Earth.
It's got a quite interesting way of propelling itself as well. It's got four ion drives on board, which have xenon that microwaves are fired at by inside the satellite itself, and they fire small charged particles out of the back, xenon particles, and that's how it will propel itself back to Earth.
It's those kind of fuel supplies are very good because you don't need much mass of fuel.
That's right.
I mean, a very strong electric field to generate the. So you need power, solar power, normally to be able to generate the power to fire those microwaves at the xenon. But you don't need, you know, kilograms of
Of fuel. And you don't need stuff that's combustible as well. And you know, all of that is really good when you're making something like this. This is a mission of the Japanese space agency, JAXA, but as with all of these, it's an international collaboration of many countries.
So, fingers crossed that the indications are that the landing has gone, the touchdown and collection has gone very well, and I guess we may not find out totally until it actually returns to Earth.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess there's no camera inside the capsule, I'm guessing, but who knows. In other, so that was a Japanese mission. Japan have got a very mature space agency. They do quite a lot of missions around the solar system and up into space. They've got had their own astronauts and so on as well. But other nations, other countries that haven't got as much space experience are places like Israel. Israel now has a mission that's going to the moon. It's called Bereshit, which is Hebrew for Genesis. And it's going to take a couple of months to get there because it was piggybacked on the back of a launch of another mission, an Indonesian communication satellite launched by SpaceX, the private, the commercial space launch company based in the US. And that's also going to hop around the moon. And hopping around is very useful for exploring.
Yes, that's right, because if you have to drive somewhere, you have to... It actually takes quite a long time, and you have to be very careful about the terrain. But if you're hopping, you can just leap over things. And the moon, again, has much lower gravity than the Earth, so hopping is actually pretty good. When you think about the Apollo astronauts, they hopped around the moon themselves.
The challenge here is that this has got a chemical engine with rocket fuel and so on, and explosive materials, you know, combustible materials. So they have to lower down on its rocket, stop the rocket, touch down, and then start the rocket again to take off. And that always comes with risks.
Yeah.
I know with the, it was a long time ago, but the Apollo lunar landers had a problem where the rocket they used to take off from the moon could only ever be fired once because it essentially damaged itself when firing. So they couldn't test it because they had to test it. They'd have to take it apart and rebuild it again, at which point there was no point in testing it.
It's a different rocket then,
So hopefully this clearly isn't that because they're going to land and take off again. But it's this is much, much cheaper than things like Apollo. There's no people on board for a start, which makes it a lot cheaper. But a mere $100 million, which for a space mission is pretty cheap.
Yes, you'd expect an extra zero on that, really. But this is really, I think, the start of a new era of this interplanetary exploration by putting something that is going to another body onto a SpaceX, a commercial launch vehicle, I think is really going to pave the way for what happens now. With it becomes more affordable for countries that can't afford to have fully fledged space programs, you know, historically. You tend to think about the European Space Agency, NASA, JAXA, but countries now like India and now Israel are really starting to flourish with a lot of the pioneering work has been done by other countries and being able to outsource things like the launch rockets.
And this mission actually started with there was a Google Lunar X Prize a few years ago now that was a prize that that Google offered. I forget what it was for something like $100 million. It was for a large amount of money for the first people who could successfully land on the moon. And no one did it in the time frame, so there was no prize given. So that saved Google a bit of money. I'm sure they were grateful for
that. And also the amount of money, it seemed like a huge amount, but it was actually would have always been less than the amount that they would spend on actually getting to the moon.
The mission continued anyway. They invested the money. It takes a bit like the Voyager spacecraft took CDs, took records out to the outer solar system. This has got a time capsule on board, so it's got on board a lunar library with several tens of millions of pages on a disc from about lunar research, and also a photo of an Israeli astronaut who sadly died in the Columbia accident in 2003.
Oh yeah.
So that's gone up there as well as a little time capsule to go up to the moon, because this spacecraft is not coming back to Earth. Once it's hopped around, it will then stay on the moon.
It's quite an interesting thing to put a time capsule in somewhere that people don't exist. It's almost saying, we really hope there will be lunar colonists at some point that will be able to dig this up and look at what the current state of lunar research is. And it'll be, what a time capsule is supposed to be, a historical document or a snapshot of the time.
Yes, I remember doing that in Blue Peter. Many years ago. Yeah, you're right, and I guess as you said earlier, the future of space travel is likely to be with these commercial launch agencies, and so it's very likely we're going to have in the coming decades, probably not the next few years, but the coming decades, people walking around, exploring the moon. Not quite big settlements yet, but
I can't wait for the first lunar hotel.
Yeah, yes, I wonder how much that'll cost.
Yeah.
So, good luck to the Space IL and the Beresheet mission. Further out in the solar system, we've just talked about the Earth's moon. A moon, Neptune, a new moon discovered back in 2013 that is slightly unusual. It's very close to another moon. It's got a slightly bizarre name. It's called Hippocamp, which might remind people of bits of the brain, the hippocampus, of course. And that's because they're both named after Greek deities. And this
it's a seahorse.
Oh, is it a seahorse?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. excellent. A Greek seahorse.
Yeah.
In mythology. So Hippocamp is unusual or unexpected because it was very close to another moon, Proteus. And you don't expect that. You expect them to affect each other and either swallow up or be kicked out.
Yeah, that's right. And that suggests that it actually chipped off a long, long time ago, billions of years ago. And that's why it's so small. So there was something that hit Proteus and chipped this bit off, and this bit has now, probably over billions of years, formed into not a chip shape, but has sort of squished itself because of its own gravity into probably a potato-y shape.
Yeah, they're always potato shapes, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting to be able to study these moons further. And maybe it does pose... The question that comes up again and again of whether we're going to end up with missions to the outer solar system. We've obviously had New Horizons out there recently, but missions to go in orbit either Uranus or Neptune, probably not both, to go and study them in more detail.
It's actually quite interesting that the place that made this discovery was the SETI Institute, which we traditionally think about as being a one-trick pony. Only really concerned with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But actually, they do a lot of solar system studies as well.
Yes, it's certainly branched out on its research fields in recent years. Moving outwards from the solar system, we've had a study, or the first big results from a radio telescope called LOFAR, which is a low-frequency array. So it looks at very, very long wavelengths of radio light. And allows it to see galaxies in a very, very distant universe. And we've had the first images come out of it with thousands of new galaxies.
Yeah, LOFAR is... So as astronomers, we're quite comfortable with the fact that the Netherlands is one of the big players in radio astronomy. But listeners may not be aware that the Netherlands does have this history. It's quite a strange collection of countries that are up there with the... That have a strong history of radio astronomy. There's the UK, obviously Jodrell Bank is one of the biggest ones, the Netherlands and Australia, with the Parkes Observatory. And also, you know, you've got to think of the US as well.
Yeah.
But radio astronomy really, 40 years ago, was the next big hope. It was the supposedly going to bring astronomical research out of the Dark Ages. As radio astronomy and submillimeter, which is halfway in between radio and infrared light, was really the instrumentation for that was and the equipment for that was really being invented about 40 years ago.
And the radio telescope as well, LOFAR, it doesn't look like a radio telescope. If you think about Jodrell Bank, if people have seen pictures of that, it's a very big dish, 70 metres across, and you get dishes that are hundreds of metres across as well. But this is not one of these. It's something called an interferometer. It's lots of different detectors working together, and each detector doesn't look like a telescope or even a radio telescope. It looks like a little antenna.
Yeah, it looks like a stick.
Yeah.
So if you see LOFAR, it's actually very disappointing because it's a field with sticks in it.
Yes.
And some plates on the floor.
Astronomers had to collaborate with potato farmers, I believe,
to get this
working. And there are stations all over Europe, not just in the Netherlands.
That's right.
That are spread over thousands of kilometres. So I think there's a station in the UK near Chilbolton.
And actually, that's one of the great things about radio astronomy is that you can stitch these things together. And by stitching more of them, you can get more precise images and more precise measurements.
But the array has detected thousands of galaxies so far. It's about 10% of the data they've taken at the moment. And even that was only something like 2% of the sky, some tiny fraction of the sky that observed. And in the end, they're going to detect more than 10 million sources out in the distant universe. And they're looking at radio waves. They're seeing the emission from generally near the cores of galaxies around those central black holes where there's very energetic processes going on. So it's a very different way of looking at the at the universe.
One of the other things they're looking at is the magnetic fields. magnetic fields are quite elusive in many other ways, but they have a massive impact on how galaxies form and how they evolve and how stars form. And so understanding where the magnetic fields are can really change the way that we understand these things.
And that's something that technology has made easier over recent years and decades, as technology has got better at being able to look at something called the polarization of the light, the properties of the light as it comes in, has meant that we can then disentangle the magnetism information from what we're collecting. And we're now doing that at lots of different wavelengths, not just radio wavelengths, but also optical light, that we normal astronomy light, if you like, but then also in the infrared and the sublimeter and so on, as you say. The SOFIA telescope, I believe, this telescope on a plane, also looks at polarized light and can learn a lot more about it. And so we can start to study the effects of magnetic fields on star formation and so on as well through that. So lots more to come from LOFAR over coming years, and it's a taste of things to come with the next generation of radio telescopes, things like the Square Kilometre Array, which is going to be based in Southern Africa and Australia, and that's going to produce even more data, hundreds of times more data than LOFAR is. So
yes.
The challenges for storing that data and analysing that data are huge.
I think actually it has to be analysed. It can never be stored in its entirety. It's temporarily stored and then analysed, and then that is stored because there's just way too much data.
So far the data centre in the Netherlands hosts 20 petabytes of LOFAR data, and one petabyte is 1,000 terabytes, so it's 1 million gigabytes. So 20 million gigabytes of data stored in that data centre, as you say, and that's not the full set. So big challenges for astronomers to be able to analyse that. Okay, moving back closer to home and missions to Mars. We had the untimely end, but the Opportunity mission has finally come to an end. The attempts to communicate with the rover have finished. After more than 15 years on the surface of Mars, which for something that was meant to last 3 months is quite impressive. So it's outlasted by a factor of 50 or more. The mission had suffered from the global dust storm on Mars. The Mars-wide dust storm, or covered a large fraction of Mars late last year, that stopped it being able to take power in its solar panels, and somehow it didn't recover. Something went wrong with its software. It's quite an old rover. There were lots of software
issues. That's right, yeah. It is a shame because you think of this rover as being part of the furniture, really, in Mars. It's been such a constant that you imagine it's like the elderly relative that you imagine will just go forever and then one day is gone. And it's actually quite sad. But there is a new hope for Mars. And actually Mars has a lot of interest from space agencies. And there are lots of missions, particularly the European Space Agency mission, ExoMars.
Yes, which so that's due to launch in 2020 and get there the next year. And the rover's being built here in the UK over in Stevenage by Airbus. And it's a European collaboration, lots of countries working together on that. And because the UK is building the rover, they got the choice of naming it. And there was a public poll. Rover McRoverface was discounted fairly early on. But the name that's been chosen is Rosalind Franklin, who is a scientist in the 1950s who worked on the discovery of DNA. Played a very large part, largely uncredited.
Yes, mostly uncredited, and there is some controversy surrounding the discovery of DNA, and it's fantastic to see her get recognition in this way, and hopefully that will make people want to recognise her work more than maybe currently it is.
And of course, the name Rosalind Franklin, you know, associated with DNA being attributed to a Mars rover, that sounds slightly odd. You know, what's DNA got to do with Mars? Well, possibly a lot, because ExoMars is going to look for signs of life on Mars, which basically means for looking for the signatures of things like DNA, the chemical signatures of DNA, either that is there or that used to be there in the past. So again, another exciting mission due for launch in a couple of years.
ExoMars is actually a two-part mission. The first part, the Schiaparelli lander from 2 years ago, had a rather unfortunate descent onto the surface of Mars. Actually, everything about the mission worked except the landing.
Yeah, they even got data back as it went down.
Exactly, yeah.
And that was talking to the Trace Gas Orbiter, which is the other big bit that's there, that's still there doing... it's been doing an aerobraking manoeuvre, which means instead of using its thrusters to slow down, it slowly just descends into the Martian atmosphere to slow it down slowly over the course of a year or so to get into its final science orbit. And that's just started taking data looking at the climate of Mars and the trace gases in its atmosphere, things like methane and so on, which could tell us something about the history of Mars's atmosphere. And that's, I think, what ExoMars is all about, is looking at the history of the atmosphere and seeing whether there are any signs of current or past life on the surface. So another exciting mission. I'm joined on the line by Paul Meacham from Airbus, who's the lead systems engineer on the ExoMars rover based here in the UK. So, Paul, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Well, we spoke a few years ago, on Pythagorean Astronomy about ExoMars and the rover and what was planned. A lot has happened since then. I guess you've had your work cut out to design and build the thing. So what's the progress on the ExoMars rover at the moment? Where are we?
You're absolutely right. We've had massive progress since we last spoke. I mean, first and foremost, we completed a really huge and important test campaign on one of the models of the rover called the STM, or Structural Thermal Model. And as the name suggests, it does the mechanical and the thermal qualification. So we were out in Toulouse last summer. We were shaking it. We were blasting noise at it. We were setting off all the pyro and hold-down mechanisms that hold the rover to the platform, and then we were thermally cycling it as well to simulate Martian days and make sure the rover could handle all that. So that's been really exciting. And then, of course, we're now moving on to the flight build, which has its own set of challenges, because the flight rover has to be built in a completely sterilized facility in order to avoid taking any sort of organic contamination with it to Mars. So that's quite a difficult build, and then that itself will go out to test this summer again in Toulouse, and to do the final testing of the rover before it eventually sort of makes its way to Russia for launch.
And the fact that it has to be sterile is just because when this thing goes to Mars, it doesn't want to take any Earth microbes with it, that when it goes and finds signs of microbes on Mars, it then won't know where they're from, effectively. That's main reason.
Yeah, you're right. It's sort of twofold, actually. You certainly don't want a false positive on one of your instruments where you think you found something really interesting and complicated and it turns out to be contamination from Earth. But secondly to that, I mean, it's actually almost the law that says the from a scientific and almost an ethical point of view, to not contaminate the body, the planet, the moon, whatever it is you're studying with any microbes from Earth as well. So we have that sort of obligation from two directions.
And that's an international agreement through the United Nations called Planetary Protection, right?
The board is called COSPAR, and they put together these rules about the different levels of planetary protection and what that practically involves in terms of actually number of what we call spores on the rover and so on. So Mars is not the highest level of planetary protection, but it certainly is still high enough to be very challenging.
So out of interest, where's got the highest level of planetary protection?
It tends to be places like the icy moons of Jupiter, like Europa, and that sort of thing, where we think there are liquid oceans and that sort of thing. They tend to have the very highest levels.
Right. Fair enough. So the reason that we care so much about microbes on Mars, as well as protecting Mars from our own Earth microbes, is that there is going to be a test of whether there's life on Mars. So what kind of things is ExoMars going to be looking for when it gets there?
So predominantly, it's looking for biomarkers. So these are the very basic building blocks of life that we think are common from starting with a creature like us all the way down to sort of a bacteria. So things like proteins, amino acids, predominantly carbon-based. We think they will be carbon-based given the range of chemicals available in the solar system when it was forming. So the idea is that These sort of organic molecules are really a marker of almost any type of carbon-based life. But the critical element is that we don't think the life is on the surface. We believe it is buried in the rock, sort of about 2 meters down or so in a permafrost layer. So the water that we think once flowed on the surface of Mars has now sort of sunk down through the rock table and frozen. And if our assumptions are correct, there could well be life living in that layer. So we want to take a sample and bring it back up to the surface to look for these biomarkers. And then, of course, that on its own is not really enough. It's great if we find life, but we also want to know under what conditions we found it. So there's a lot of other instruments that sort of are looking for more the chemical composition of the sample we take. Was there water present? What sort of compounds were present where we found life, or conversely didn't find life, depending on what we find?
So definitely looking for signature of life, or I guess past life. So if there's not life there now, but there used to be a long time ago, do you think it will be able to find evidence of that, or is that too hard a task?
Yeah. These biomarkers persist. Even if the life is no longer current, it'll still give us the indication that it was there, yes.
And this searching for biomarkers is why the name Rosalind Franklin is so appropriate. So this was a shortlist. There was a bit of a vote on it for what the rover should be named. And it's a very appropriate name for this mission, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah. We had something like 36,000 entries. So you can imagine there was quite a breadth of different names, starting with the sort of opportunity, curiosity, spirit type names that the NASA rovers use, all the way through to some quite amusing ones, actually, and of course the inevitable Rover McRover face, which of course we had to filter out. But yeah, I mean, Rosalind Franklin did stand out as a name, partly because it gives, I think, the rover a bit of personality to be named after someone, but also, of course, Rosalind had a massive sort of contribution to the study of DNA, which of course we're looking for the signs of life on Mars. So it all ties together quite nicely.
Now, the ExoMars rover is going to be, I guess you could call it, the third or fourth generation of rover that's going to Mars. So we started off back in 1995 with the Sojourner rover, the little NASA Pathfinder mission, with something that's about the size, I think it used to be called the size of a tea tray kind of size. And then Spirit and Opportunity, which we'll touch on in a second, Curiosity, and then things like ExoMars, and there's another mission going from NASA as well on a similar kind of timescale. And we've learnt all the way along, I guess, what Mars is like and what Mars used to be like. So with relevance particularly to Opportunity, whose mission has just come to an end officially after the dust storm that probably resulted in it losing power, what have we learnt from Opportunity that feeds into the ExoMars mission, particularly the rover side of it?
So there's been two areas, the science and the engineering. On the science side, Opportunity found a lot of evidence for water having flown on the surface at some point in Mars's history. Firstly, just looking at the landscape, but then looking a little bit closer, there were several sort of particles that looked like they'd been shaped by the presence of water, where they'd sort of been smoothed down to be almost spherical.
So like by the pebbles you might find on the bottom of a riverbed.
Yeah, exactly the same process.
Yeah, okay.
And then, of course, a sort of more chemical evidence. So there are certain oxides of iron that only form in the presence of water, and it found those as well. So there's a great deal of evidence that sort of influences the places on Mars we will be travelling to take samples based on those results. And then on the engineering side, of course, which where there's a lot of applicability to us at Airbus, there were primarily three things that they were very keen to have if they could do Opportunity again. The first was middle wheel steering, so they could sort of go sideways like a crab as well as follow curves. So our rover has middle wheel steering. The second was something called wheel walking, which is sort of a method of locomotion, which doesn't involve sort of turning your wheels conventionally, but moving one forward at a time, and then the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, then standing back up again. So it's extremely slow, but seen sped up, it looks like the rover is walking.
So you pick the wheels up as if it's a foot. Is that the idea?
Yeah, not quite. It just tends to push the wheel forward.
Right. Okay.
The leg sort of tilts forward, pushing the wheel along. But the thing about it is, because you're only moving one wheel at a time, the other five are keeping you stable. So it's a very safe way of moving around. It's not good for normal locomotion, but what you find is if you drive into an area of particularly soft sand, where normal locomotion will cause you to get stuck because it'll start to dig you in, you can switch to this wheel walking mode and walk your way out of these scenarios in a very controlled manner. So that was another thing that I thought would be very useful. Mm. The third is the autonomy. So Opportunity has three sort of main ways of driving it. It can be sort of given almost to what we call direct drive commands, to drive at a certain speed for a certain amount of time. It can follow a path that's been preordained for it back on Earth, or it can use the version of autonomy they have on Opportunity. But the difference with our rover is that autonomy is pretty much the main way we move around. Which does, cause some challenges, but it means that our autonomy has to be extremely robust and reliable and be able to handle almost any type of scenario on Mars. So that is another feature that we've taken lead from Opportunity.
So a lot of technological developments that have been learned from over the years. That's certainly good to see. It means we're getting better at doing this, I guess. The other thing that Opportunity has done is outlisted its mission lifetime by a factor of something like 50. Has that fed into any estimations of how long the ExoMars, or how long Rosalind Franklin, the rover, will last?
Not directly, insofar as we often things like that can come down to sort of component lifetimes, and we use very different components to the American rovers because we have to use. Buy primarily from the European market, but certainly it does give us some interesting information on the level of dust that we can expect to land on the arrays during this mission lifetime. Ultimately, with the exception of a sort of direct component failure, it's far more likely that eventually there'll be so much dust on the arrays that we will not be able to generate enough power to keep the rover alive at night, to keep its battery warm, and at that point, it's the end of the mission. So it's something that we have to factor in our design, and so you can take some information about the level of dust that was falling on the rover. That certainly is relevant. But inevitably, these rovers are all over-engineered in some way, because we have to guarantee the nominal lifetime. Now, in the case of Opportunity, that was 90 sols. In the case of us, it's 218 souls. So inevitably, you oversize your array slightly, you build in lots of redundancy and so on to make sure that you almost guarantee that the rover will work for that initial nominal mission. And then anything beyond that is a bonus. But because you've over-engineered, as opportunity has shown, you can go well, well beyond the design lifetime without really having to worry about the failure of components and so on.
And actually, we're getting quite used to missions doing this as well. I mean, not just on Mars. Curiosity rover, of course, was landed. It expected a two-year mission, and it's now six or seven years in to that. Yeah. So that's gone a long time. And then a lot of missions out in the outer solar system have lasted well beyond when they were kind of at least designed to initially. And things like the Hubble Space Telescope, albeit with a few repairs, outlasting its original intention. So. Yeah, that is something. I guess you're right that the over-engineering certainly helps with that, as long as it doesn't set the expectations too high, I suppose.
Yes, that's true. I mean, of course, with all these sorts of spacecraft, you can manage your depleting resources. So, for example, maybe after a couple of years on Mars, a drive that took you a day in the early part of the mission might take you three, but you know how much power you've got available. The software can handle sort of resource management to make sure you're not going to completely deplete the battery with what activity you've got planned, and therefore you, as long as you spread things out a little bit, you can keep the rover going or any spacecraft going for as long as possible, and so that's where we see the sorts of lifetimes of spacecraft that we do.
Yeah, and it does make some of the engineers look like miracle workers, I suppose, in terms of making things work, which must be gratifying, I suppose.
Yes, but as you say, there is an expectation that comes with that for all spacecraft to go well beyond their design lifetime, and that's not always possible, unfortunately.
Now, ExoMars is part of a multi-part mission. The first part of the mission is already there, the Trace Gas Orbiter, along with its mostly failed lander or the lander that didn't quite survive the impact or the landing on Mars, the Schiaparelli. How is the Trace Gas Orbiter going to interact with the rover, or are they entirely different components?
There's sort of two ways they interact. The first is the actual science that the Trace Gas Orbiter is doing. So, as the name suggests, it's looking for trace gases, particularly methane in the upper atmosphere. And methane is a great marker for sort of subsurface life, because it's one of the sources of methane, can be organic molecules. But then it has a more direct relationship, a more direct interface once we arrive, because that's our primary relay orbiter. Our rover doesn't have a direct-to-Earth link. It has to communicate via an orbiter. Now, it can do that with any of the orbiters around Mars, but of course, Trace Gas Orbiter being part of the same mission, it's much more easy to get the time you need with that satellite, that orbiter, to talk back to Earth and get new commands and so on. So it's our primary relay orbiter when we arrive.
What limits the rover's ability to talk directly to Earth? Is it the antenna size? It doesn't have as big enough radio dish to talk to Earth, or is it the frequency, the radio frequencies it's using?
It's a bit of both. It certainly would need to be a much higher power antenna to get back to the Earth. It would also need to be steerable, such that it could track the Earth as it moved across the Martian sky. There are some times in the year where the Earth does not actually rise very far at all above the Martian horizon, and that means you've got massive what we call attenuation of the signal going through Mars's atmosphere almost sideways. So you do need a very powerful antenna to be able to cope with that. Whereas we can use pretty much a standard UHF antenna, much, much simpler design, doesn't need steering or anything like that to talk to an orbiter which is only 500 kilometres above our heads.
There's certainly all the issues that I guess we don't think about when we're imagining these missions in the far future. And it's a very exciting mission. We're certainly looking forward to what Rosalind Franklin, as a rover, is going to do on the surface of Mars. Is there a feel for, is it going to be called a shortened version of the name, Rosalind or Rosalind Franklin? Is there any feel on that yet within Airbus?
There hasn't been yet. I'm aware that she didn't like being called Rosie. actually. Right. So we tend not to call it Rosie the Rover, but I can imagine we might just shorten it to Rosalind Rover. That sounds quite nice too.
It's quite alliterative as well. Yeah. Rosalind Rover, yeah. Well, we look forward to what Rosalind Rover does for us in a few years' time, sending us back information about past or present life on Mars. And good luck with the rest of the development and all the testing of those rovers in the UK and then in Toulouse as well. Paul Meacham, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lots of news from lots of missions and lots of missions to look forward to in the future. Don't forget, if you go to pythagastro.uk, you can find past episodes of Pythagorean Astronomy and also subscribe to the podcast. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.